Accession number 30277, Reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Bob Long at his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 30th of the 8th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bob, I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about the training, about getting involved. But what was it like to literally join up?
Suddenly be a soldier.
Yeah.
In other words, it was fairly traumatic, I suppose. We had no idea of really military discipline or anything like that, of course, being 18 or 19-year-olds. But my friend and I decided that we would join the militia. He was keen on following his brother, who was in the 2nd 16th in Africa. And just as a little bit of an introductory part of life, we joined the 28th Battalion Militia.
Well, you're mentioning that when the Japanese came in, all thoughts of going to North Africa, all thoughts of that was out. And you mentioned also being involved with the Brisbane Lions.
Indeed, yes. That was later when we were in the Armoured Division, of course. The reason behind going into signals was my mate, his brother was in signals in the 2nd 16th, and he said, well, that's what we better be in. We had no idea of what to be in, but we thought that was quite a good idea. Had no idea of Morse code, signal flags, lamps, heliograph or anything else. So we were accepted into that.
Had you ever thought you should get into the sort of sharp end of the army?
Don't think that occurred to us. I was rather led by my friend whose brother was in the 2nd 16th as a signalman, and we thought that was an attractive thing to do, and we went along and they accepted us into that capacity.
Mm. Let's talk then about what it was like to learn the art of Morse, the semaphore, the...
Yes, it was difficult, in as much as we had never in our lives ever been associated with anything in the way of communications, and suddenly we had semaphore with flags, Morse with flags, heliograph with the army telescopes, Lucas lamps also with army telescopes, and telephones, and we had our own cable laying truck in the 28th. And during the camp, the one camp that we did, something magical arrived, and only the officer and the sergeant were allowed to get near it. Was a what they called a 10-line universal call exchange, which, as it says, it's got 10 lines, and you can use it as a telephone exchange. Apart from that, we were very slow at learning it, very slow indeed. Everything, the basis of most of the things was Morse, of course, and that takes a bit of grasping, quite a bit of grasping, particularly... when you've got to read it with a telescope. So we liked it, and we progressed from there into Armoured Division with the same idea, and was accepted there too.
Well, you do mention to me earlier on, you know, it was one of those situations of hurry up and slow down.
Hurry up and wait. Yes, indeed. It seems that way. I had the worst rifle in the 28th Battalion, and it was marked 1915 manufacture, and it looked as though it had been through the trenches too.
Talking about broomsticks at one point.
Oh yes, that was later. That was later. Yes, in the militia had their own armoury, as you might say, and they held on to that armoury. So if and when AIF began to form, they had to draw their firearms from some other place, and of course there was no more firearms, so that's when we did the broomstick thing. But
mentioning this 1915 World War One vintage rifle,
303,
and my impression is that they were sort of all greased up and put into bags and left for the next war, literally.
I think that's what happened, and mine, the barrel was so terrible that if a visiting officer inspected us and inspected our rifles, he immediately wanted to put me on a charge sheet until our sergeant came along and rescued it and said, "Sir, that rifle is just like that. You can't clean it anymore." So I was glad to be shot of that rifle and give it back to 28th Battalion. Yes.
Well, here you are. You're in the signals.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Corps. What was that like? You know, here you are trying to learn Morse through telescopes, all the rest. But people do say that their training was a learning experience. You know, here you are learning another.
Of course, yeah. And I still remember it to this day. I can still read Morse now. If any comes across the radios that I have, I can still read it. Not as fast as I did, but I can still send it quite accurately and fairly fast. So it does stay with you, like learning another language, and it stays there. But the signal platoon, of course, was part of headquarters company in battalions, and as such, you are favoured a little bit, as you don't have to do a lot of the kitchen chores. Most of the kitchen chores you don't have to do. You don't have to do guard duties. And the intelligence section, which is part of headquarters company, they also do not have to do those things. But it was the recognised thing that in each 3 months camp, the signal platoon would put on one guard, just as a favour to all the other men in the battalion. And we did that getting towards the end of our 3 months. This was, as you said last time, it was during the phony war, when everything was a sort of a stalemate, and it wasn't taken all that seriously here. And thus, the militia went in for 3 months and went out for 3 months and then went in another 3 months.
You mentioned, too, that you were in Sydney when you believe you saw machine guns firing at possible submarines in the harbour.
Yes, I'll never know whether it was the night or not, but I was in Sydney and living in a 3 or 4 storey house, apartment in Milsons Point on the north side of the bridge, and during the night, midnight, 1 o'clock, sometime like that, I woke up to the machine guns firing from the top of the pylons.
Well, obviously, and we've spoken about this too, the Japanese became the threat, particularly for Australia. Things were really serious at that point.
Yes.
Obviously, you'd had Dunkirk and things like that that sort of shook everyone into action.
It did.
But nothing like, presumably, the way that the closeness of the Japanese force would.
Yeah.
You, at this point, I understand, were in Z-Force, or preparing to be in Z-Force at this point.
When the Japanese came into the war, I was actually in Headquarters Company Armoured Division in camp just out of a place called Rokeby in Victoria. Just prior to that, we'd been issued with our sea kits ready to embark on the ships.
This was to go to North Africa?
North Africa, indeed, yes. And, of course, once that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and many other advances too, that was completely cancelled. The militia then wanted their camp back, so we had to move on and make a new camp, which we did. We stayed there for a certain period of time, but it was very mundane. There was no activity other than the normal parades, you know, that type of thing. Two of us had wireless watch, a crew of three each in watching the wireless watch 24 hours a day. That went on for a couple of months. And then we saw the Sentinel tank.
Yeah, you're mentioning the Sentinel tank with a lost track and all the rest.
It lost a track, yes. And since then I've read articles about it, and it was a very promising tank, apparently.
And you also mentioned that you got on pretty well with the Americans when they came in, were certainly involved with the war, but a curtain looks to America now. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much point in asking the English for much help.
No.
I want to move on, if we can, to your involvement with Zed Special Unit.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you how that came about.
Briefly, from Rokeby, where we were in Victoria, we went to Singleton first, then Narrabri, Gunnedah, generally Black Soil Plains area, Brisbane Line and all that. And there were some mock battles there. But largely, everything was done online. No wireless work. See, wireless work would have to be encoded and then decoded, whereas using the line plus all the PMG, as it was in those days, lines throughout the Commonwealth, they didn't have to encode. But following that, I assume that it was after the Battle of the Coral Sea, we were sent to Western Australia. West Australia was a fairly mundane sort of a period of time. There again, wireless section did not have much to do because it was all line, all through PMG and our own lines again. When the division folded up, we were sent back to Bellevue Camp and then back to Bonegilla on the near Albury on the border of Victoria and New South Wales.
So you're seeing a bit of the country.
Oh yes, yeah, quite a tourist. And
a paid tourist.
Yes. And there we were there for retraining, but not so much in the signals activity as we had a major there. He was a First World War man, and he seemed to have the attitude that we were going to finish up in trenches with rifles. And that was his training, obstacle courses, gas attacks and things like that. The gas sergeant, of course, was known as Fosgene under because of the gas in the First World War. Fortunately, an American army officer, Major Israel, called there looking for wireless operators for Zed. And he picked six, and the next week he came back and picked another six.
Let's talk about that. What did they tell you about Zed?
Very little. Very little. They said it could be exciting and it could be dangerous. But I think the attitude of most of the armoured division, they called themselves the anchored division because of very, very little activity and mostly in Australia. And there again, they call themselves the IAF, In Australia Forever, instead of AIF. But where did I get to? Yes, Major Israel. I was one of the second six that went. I think it was 12. I made some notes and I put all the names down there, and I'm pretty sure there was 12 that were picked up. We were given rail passes and got as far as Brisbane, where we were spent a night at Milton Tennis Courts. They had a staging camp at Milton Tennis Courts with a couple of tents at the back. Next day we were sent by train to Maryborough, where we were met by a truck. The truck took us to Yarangan in Hervey Bay, opposite Fraser Island, met by an officer, Captain Ellis, and he said to us, there's your transport to Fraser Island, in the form of a diesel launch, the Alapna. He said, if you can push it off the mud, you can get to Fraser and get a meal. So we took boots and socks and trousers off and got in the mud, and it was thick, and pushed her off, and of course got to Fraser Island that day.
But here you are, being sort of sent off on some possibly dangerous, possibly exciting operation, presumably not really knowing what you were up for.
Exactly, yes.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, I think we were all for it, because we were heartily fed up with sort of stooging around Australia and the inactivity of it. Being the line fellows were all right, because they were busy all the time, full of phones, telephones and universal call exchanges and things like that, trucks full of them. So they were active. But, we were introduced to the syllabus, and there's Morse code, wireless repair, demolition, that was with the gelignite, which we handled on that first day and got terrible headaches. That was experience. That they didn't tell us we get headaches out of handling it. Plastic explosive, time pencils, fuse instantaneous, primers and limpets. And these sections were set up to do maybe two hours a week of that.
What sort of briefing were you given when you finally reached your destination? We were talking about Fraser Island, but what were you being told?
From memory, I can't think of what we were told, other than to to get into that tent and make yourself comfortable, and meals will be here and there. There's the marquee where the Morse training goes, and that was it, until you get further along, because there was a sorting out, as you might say, at that period of time. If you didn't make it, you were perhaps sent back to your unit or made a general duties.
Well, presumably, if you knew what you were letting yourself in for, if you knew, had some idea what you were training for, you would perform better.
Well, perhaps. But this was a challenge. There's no doubt about it. This was a challenge, a bit more excitement, I guess. Other things that we had to do was map reading, aircraft recognition, shipping recognition, unarmed combat, horse riding. The Army had a half a dozen second-class racehorses. So we had to saddle them and ride them. And also they brought over some pack horses. We had to learn how to put the packs on them and lead them. So that was in it. Pack horse saddling and leading, physical training. We had to do medical couple of hours a week in medical, learn how to administer a quarter grain of morphia and patch up people, how to suture up a wound. So it was pretty complete. Those are the things that I can remember. There were other things like certain amount of swimming, but it was split into two sections, and you did so many hours of this or that. Unarmed combat, of course. Unarmed combat, they had deep sand to do unarmed combat in, so that, of course, with the perspiration pouring off you and blokes trying to dig their hand into your eyes or something like that, it was dinkum stuff. And I can remember having the eyelids all sore through getting too dinkum with somebody. Yes. And at the end of 8 weeks, our foal boating came into it too. That was another pretty exciting thing, foal boating. They were testing, on this particular occasion, they were testing us for navigation, because they wanted people over on Garden Island in Western Australia to do the midget submarine course. And
presumably you were sort of getting an idea that this wasn't just the normal
this was
pretty
hairy. Yes, we were getting the idea it was pretty hairy.
Did anyone talk to you about, you know, secret commando, this, that and the other? Had anyone actually sort of sat down with you in a briefing room and told everyone what was planned, what you were actually being trained for?
No, I don't think so. No, we sort of knew that we were going to be involved perhaps in forward headquarters, parties in the field, but nothing specific at that stage.
Would it be fair to say that you volunteered for this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it was only on a voluntary basis, and no married men were supposed to be accepted. It was a single man's thing. That didn't necessarily happen. There were married men that got through the system. And one was beheaded in Singapore. One of their armoured div fellas. Yeah. Yes, sad thing.
In relation to your training, though, here we are. You're learning how to do unarmed combat with people and set limpet mines and headaches from gel ignite, all that sort of thing. I'm interested to discuss what you were sort of formulating with your comrades about what this might be.
I suppose there was some speculation. There must have been a lot of speculation as to what the ultimate would be. But the 8 weeks went fairly quickly without too much thought. And at that time, at the end of that, we were allocated a party. There would have been other parties apart from Simut, but we didn't know about it. They didn't encourage socialising too much because of the possibility of leakage of from this party to that party. And so
tell us the origin of Simut.
The origins would have been probably at down at headquarters in Toorak, Melbourne. There were quite a number of people who had been working in the islands, planters, Shell representatives, and people like that. I would suspect that, knowing that they were so good at speaking the Malay language, they probably selected Simut as a cover name, like they picked Agus. Agus is sandfly. Sandfly in Malay, and Simut is ant. So
presumably you knew that you were going to be heading up to the islands to do something.
Yes, yes.
obviously, we're reading some of this from, or taking some of the information from a book that you've written called Zed Special Units Secret War, Operation Simut 1, Soldiering with Headhunters of Borneo. You talk of a number of the activities that you were involved with, and you were mentioning foal boating, but you're also talking about parachuting.
Oh, yes.
Let's just go through a few of the things that you mentioned. In relation to learning the sort of explosive side of things, what were you being taught? Describe what you were being taught. You mentioned getting headaches from jet lag.
As far as the explosive was concerned, the instructor took us through the makeup of making a charge. Plastic explosive, for argument's sake, he would say, now you can do anything with this. You can chew it, you can chuck it up against a wall, you can jump on it. It will not go off. So you have to put your plastic explosive around a primer, and then your detonator goes into the hole in the primer, and then your fuse. If you're going to put fuse instantaneous, that goes off bang straight away. If you're going to put blue fuse, that will burn at so many feet per minute or whatever, and a time pencil on the end of it for the particular time that you want the delay before it goes off. We had a situation, three of us were planting and blowing up an old metal boiler.
Steam engine boiler.
Yes, yes. We were blowing that up, and we set the charge, and each of the three of us had to do a certain thing. Somebody had to make up the primer into the plastic explosive. The next one crimped the detonator onto the fuse and put that in. And the third one put the time pencil on, pressed it, and then pulled the safety pin out, and off we went, very fast. And it didn't go off. And the instructor was there. It was only a 2 minute time pencil, and 10 minutes went by, and he came back to it. He wouldn't let us, but he went and had a look, pulled it apart, and then he quizzed everybody as to what they did. And the last bloke, he should have pressed the time pencil, then pulled the safety pin out. Well, he did it back to front. He pulled the safety pin out and pressed the time pencil and broke the wire, and it fired. But it didn't go off. Somebody up there looking after us. And he put another one on, pressed it, pulled the key out of it, and we scattered, and away it went. It exploded that time. Yes,